Hey, Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. You know, one of the perks about having four kids that you know about is actually getting a direct line to the big man up north. Mm-hmm. And this year, he wants you to know the best gift that you can give someone is the gift of Mint Mobile's unlimited wireless for $15 a month. Now, you don't even need to wrap it. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 for 3 month plan equivalent to $15 per month required. New customer offer for first 3 months only. Speed slow after 35 gigabytes if network's busy. Taxes and fees extra. See mintmobile.com.
Hey everybody, it's Mark Pattison. I'm back again with another fantastic episode of Finding Your Summit, all about people overcoming adversity and finding their way. And as we all know, today is March 25th. This episode is being broadcast out into the future, but we're all dealing with the coronavirus, so trying to hopefully get that resolved. As everybody knows now, my trip to Everest is canceled, but I continue to write on my blog. You can find that at www.markpattisonnfl.com. And I continue to fundraise for my daughter who has epilepsy called Amelia's Everest. So making progress on that front. So as always, would love to have your ratings and reviews. It's not about me. It's about these amazing people that I have on the pod, like today's guest, Ronnie Cicely, NBA star, NBA legend. And it just helps elevate people. We all need to be inspired just like I do. So on that note, let's jump into the pod. Ronnie, how are you doing? And welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Yeah. So the first question I got to ask you, and this is, there's kind of a lot more to this question, is where are you from?
So I was born in Lebanon, and we left Lebanon at an early age when the civil war broke out. And yep. My family moved to Greece. And that's where, you know, that's where I grew up. I was in Greece, and then from Greece, we came to the U.S. And I just stayed here, and my family just went back to Lebanon.
Yeah, and the reason why I asked you that is because I saw this just absolutely fantastic piece last night on you. As I was doing my research, this 360, it was probably 45 minutes, and you know, you struggled with that question. It seemed like for a number of years, just because the association with growing up in Beirut. And, you know, I never, for me at least, you know, we're roughly the same age. I'm just a little bit older than you. And so I was playing football in the NFL back in the day. And then you went on to this great career at Syracuse and the NBA. We'll get into that. But I always associated you with a foreign player from Greece, you know, not Beirut. And you've been in the U.S. probably longer than you actually, you know, were in Europe. And so really an American citizen. But what was that transition like for you to go from Beirut? You know, you're talking about war torn and all this craziness going into Greece. I mean, peaceful, tranquil, beautiful country.
I actually told my daughter the other day, you know, the panic and the hysteria that's going on or that was going on here last week with people arming themselves and the looting and people scared and not sure what's going on. And that mass hysteria, add closure of banks and no government. And that's how that's what you grew up in. And that was your everyday kind of life. So basically, you know, you're basically on your, you know, you leave the house and you're at risk for not catching a virus, but for either getting killed or witnessing something that's going to be very lasting on you. So it's very interesting that living in America, you guys were so oblivious to this kind of hysteria and this whole thing that's going on in America today. That's how we grew up. I mean, that's exactly how we grew up. And you know, the worst part about it is that we didn't even have electricity or water. So you would have to take a shower with a small little bottle of water. The water comes in for 2 hours a day. You got to kind of fill up your bottles of water. And your quota is one bottle of water to take a shower. Electricity would come in for 2-3 hours a day, and then the rest of the day you're living on candles and stuff. So, yeah, so it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild. And then coming to, you know, to the States where everything is just kind of given for granted, you know, electricity, you're not going to worry of not having your lights come on, or supermarkets being looted every single day and not finding food and stuff like that. So, yeah, it was a very, very harsh upbringing.
Well, so going fast forward, and then I want to stay kind of where we're at right now. Ronnie was a 12-year NBA star, number one draft pick by the Miami Heat. And so it seems like one of the challenges you would have had, and I'm sure you've got a different viewpoint about this, but one of the different challenges is as you're growing up in a war-torn country like Lebanon in Beirut, and there's all kinds of just insaneness going on around you, like how did you develop into an athlete? I mean, how you know, whether it was basketball, baseball, volleyball, these other sports, I mean, it just seems like there would be such a, it just like even almost today, you know, I mean, it's a completely different situation because we're dealing with a virus. We're not dealing with people shooting at you and rubble in the streets, but you know, we're still locked down from the standpoint of all the gyms have closed and they're now have, at least in the state of California where I'm broadcasting from, you know, all the parks and the beaches, all that kind of stuff, they're shut. So your ability to go out and do what you love to do has been very much limited. So how were you able to develop that athletic bug and that athletic skill growing up in that environment? And I know you did move over to Greece. Maybe that's where it really caught fire.
Well, I mean, as a young kid, like I'm talking, you know, at 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, I was always an athletic kid. I always loved playing sports. I wanted to snow ski. I wanted to water ski. I wanted to play tennis. I always wanted to play sports. I loved playing sports. And in Lebanon, you don't have the facilities that you do have here. So we don't have parks and we don't have this. So everything has to happen on the street. You make a makeshift backboard and makeshift rim, and you kind of, or if you're playing soccer, you put two cans of oil or whatever as your goal. And I mean, it's just all makeshift stuff. So, but I always had a bug for sports. Always loved playing sports. It just made me feel better. Just anytime I play sports, it made me happy. It made me feel better. And then as I got a little older and went to an American high school in Athens, Greece, all my friends were telling me, you know, it's a shame that you don't, you know, the only sport that I wasn't playing was basketball, because I didn't want to play basketball just because I was tall. I didn't want people to think, oh, well, he's a basketball player just because he's tall. I didn't want to be that guy, because I was excelling at other sports like, you know, soccer and tennis and all the other sports. So I didn't really want to be that goofball that's just kind of, he's, you know, the tall guy on the team, basically. And they said, you know, why don't you come out and see, we'll teach you how to play and stuff like that. And then during lunch breaks in high school, I started playing, and I had like it just became a bug. You know how people catch a bug when you're playing golf or tennis or anything? When you catch that sporting bug, the only difference between what I felt and somebody else that catches the bug is that I felt that every day that I would go out and train for basketball, I felt like I was getting better. Like every day, I never hit a plateau of, okay, I've gotten to the best possible place I could get. Like every day I would practice and I would get a little bit better, a little bit better. And that went on through my NBA career. I just kept learning and learning and learning and learning and getting more comfortable. And I never actually reached my peak, because the IQ of the game was lagging behind the athletic ability. Mm. So I was overcompensating everything with my athletic ability, but learning the game itself was behind.
Yeah, that's really interesting. The bug that you're talking about, you know, certainly with me now, it's mountain climbing all over the world. And, you know, back in the day, I was playing football in between college and the NFL, you know, same path that you went. And I think one of the things that helped drive me, which it sounds like you're very similar, is just the passion and the love of the game. I'm glad I didn't, but I would have played in the NFL for free. just because I just loved to play. I wanted to continue playing post my college. Like you, I was drafted, and I was very fortunate to kind of be in the right place at the right time. And it seems like that's really had a common theme with you, based on what I could tell, that, you know, each place that it's just kind of been random circumstance that you've been in the right place at the right time. And now what I'm talking about is you going and visiting, I think, your brother at Syracuse University, and somebody randomly is like, hey, why don't you go try out for this basketball camp just to learn and improve your game? And you weren't really thinking much beyond any of that, and you weren't being recruited by anybody. But next thing, Jim Boeheim, the longtime coach at Syracuse, comes up, and like I would if I saw somebody who is 6'10", and like, he's looking at you like, you got to be kidding me. And then you end up in a practice with a bunch of his assistant coaches. And then, you know, the rest is history.
Yes. And I truly believe this happens in real life as well. I mean, I think my journey, if I was a little kid and I had to tell you what I was going to do, I would have never guessed how I ended up or how I got to the NBA. I think it was just a series of luck and being at the right place at the right time with the right people. And it just happened organically. I wasn't looking for it, but that was my path. And I just kind of followed that path. Some people feel that that's their path and they open the doors and the doors are always closed and you got to persevere and push and persevere. And sooner or later, you'll make it. And others just, you know, you just follow your path. You just go with the flow of where you're supposed to go. And that's how it happened to me. And then I can't tell you the coincidences that have happened for me to get to Syracuse and then end up playing at Syracuse, going to the finals against Indiana in 87. Honestly, like, I feel like it's another part of my life that I had no control over. I was just kind of I was a robot going through that. And I was very fortunate that God blessed me with this talent and the way to get to where I was supposed to get to.
Well, there's no question you were a force. You're out there, you're blocking, you're shooting, you're doing all the things that you need to do. But like anything, it takes a team and to have other players around you. So it's just not a one trick pony to get you that far. That's back in the day too, when Syracuse used to seriously roll, have a lot of really good teams, and you guys make it to the final. It must have given you confidence too when you're going up against a guy like Patrick Ewing and you're blocking his shot. And as you said, you just continued to grow. And grow and get better and get better. But, you know, with experience comes confidence. And with that confidence comes more domination. And now you're dunking the ball and you're doing a bunch of crazy stuff. And you actually become a physical force out there, but also a guy with finesse that can really get to the hoop. And that's what I saw. That's what I remember back in the day when I was – at this time I was playing in the NFL. But now you're in the, you know, the college March Madness craziness, which I don't know if you ever paid attention to that stuff when you were in Greece, but it's just a gigantic basketball tournament that, you know, it's unfortunate right now that we had to postpone it or cancel it this year for all those players that are out there won't be able to experience that. But for you, you know, it's one thing to make it. It's another thing to go to the finals.
I mean, the crazy thing, Mark, is the fact that in Greece, I had no idea what March Madness was. I had no idea what the NCAAs were. I had no idea what the NBA was, because back then, the only time you would get basketball on TV, if it was the finals of the NBA, like the Lakers and the Celtics, where they show you two or three games, and that was the quota of any game you got. You never got, you know, there wasn't TV showing sports, college basketball, anything. So I really went to Syracuse completely oblivious to the fact of how big this whole thing was. And maybe that's a good thing, because I just didn't feel the pressure at all. I was just, you know, I was there to do the work. I didn't feel like I had to prove anything. I just went and I did what I had to do.
How difficult was it for you to learn the language when you came over? I know you do speak four different languages. You're a bright guy, English, Arabic, which I imagine is very difficult, Greek and French. But how difficult was that barrier, or were you already well-versed because you went to American high school in Greece?
What the most difficult thing is not the language, and it's not the education and stuff like that. It's basically the culture. You know, when you grow up in a certain culture as a little kid,
yeah,
you don't know other cultures. You don't know how other people are. You just assume that everybody's alike. Everybody's a human being, and everybody's just basically alike. But that is the thing that got me you know, where I was the most uncomfortable is the culture wise. I wasn't ready for this. For the culture that America provides. Obviously, it's the best in the world, but that's not how we grew up. So that was one that I had to overcome. And besides that, it was pretty much an easy transition.
Well, obviously, you did transition. You play out your 4 years there. They retire a number. And now in 1988, you become the ninth pick by the Miami Heat. I think it was the first draft for the Heat. Is that right?
Yeah, the first ever pick.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And you had a great career there. And, you know, you literally took a franchise, you know, off the ground floor. And, you know, it's just to be able to experience what that was like, having a town in South Beach to embrace the basketball team, show up in droves, and then build into ultimately a playoff team. And, you know, last couple of years they went to the NBA finals. So some certainly pride around being part of that. I think one of the things, and then I do want to ask you about some of these experiences that you had, but one of the things that was always difficult for me that I think a lot of people don't really understand is that when you get drafted by a team and you dig in and you're putting your roots down there and you buy a house, and in some cases you're married, in some cases you're not. What they don't understand is that when you actually, you know, get called into the office and they go, hey, you've been traded to the Warriors. Hey, you've been traded to the Magic. Hey, you've been traded to the Nets. You know, that is a very difficult thing because, you know, you think you're going to be at one team for the rest of your life. And then everything changes, you know, your address changes, your apartment changes, you know, you got to like go through all this. And then again, every team has its own dynamics. And that's one of the hardest things I always went through when I was playing, is just that uncertainty and then change.
That is, you know, you hit it right on the head. I mean, it's, you know, it's just, just the fact that you want to go cut your hair, you don't know where to go. You just to get to the practice. We didn't have Waze and stuff like that. You just have to figure out everything. Then you have to figure out the new offense. You have to figure out your teammates, and you have to start everything. It's like almost like, you know, you're back in the dating game, and you got to be on your best behavior to make the best. You know, it's one part of the business that I absolutely hated, and you know, just athletes being used as a commodity. You know, you're. And that's one, you know, one thing that I just, it left a bad taste in my mouth. And, but that's what sports are. I mean, that's exactly why we get paid a lot of money. And that's why, you know, you get pushed around and traded around like a stock. If your stock's going down, they can trade you and get some two better companies. They will. And that was the harsh reality of all that stuff. And every trade that, some trades, you're just not, you don't want to be there. So that's the welcomed ones. You want a new beginning. You want something fresh. You want the atmosphere around you. That's the thing. But when you're super happy and your kids are in school and you come back home and you pick up your kids in the morning, or you take them to school in the morning, bring them back from school in the afternoon, or whatever it is, that routine gets cut off and you got to uproot your whole family and move in places. That is not fun.
That is not fun. I've been there and I get that. So to me, during the era that you played was the Golden Era. And they're talking about Magic, Bird, Michael Jordan, you know, all these great teams. And I know there's the whole LeBron James, and we went through the Kobe phases and all that kind of stuff. But to me, that's where I just always just loved the NBA. It was much more rough and tumble. The guys from Detroit, I was trying to brawl with everybody. But what was it like playing against a guy like Michael Jordan?
There are certain athletes that, you know, usually when you're at that level, pretty much everybody's kind of equal. So you're not really mesmerized by anybody's presence.
Yep.
You know, you've got your superstars, you know, the guys that are going to score, you know, the big points and stuff like that. But Michael Jordan had an aura. He was different. It was not just another great player. He just had something that it was a little sparkle that was on the court. So you kind of got, you know, sometimes you got caught watching him because you're just mesmerized by what this guy can do. And this is in the era of the 90s where when there was a rule, you know, whoever scores 90, if you keep teams under 90 points, you're going to win the game. So it was all about defense and no easy layups, and they'll take your head off if you, I mean, and he did what he did in the 90s when the defense was two-hand checking and stuff like that. So I just couldn't imagine what he would do today in today's game.
Yeah, another guy that I really enjoyed watching, his style, his grit, his toughness was Larry Bird. I'm sure you played against him. Just for a long time.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to make. So there's three players that had this kind of like where you felt their presence on the court.
Yep.
It was Michael Jordan, obviously, Larry Bird.
Yep.
And Magic Johnson. Yep. They just commanded something that other players didn't.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's the 1% of the 1%, and then you have the half a percent of that 1%. I didn't even know what the number of the fraction is, but it's just incredible when you have that kind of talent. Obviously, LeBron James today is that type of player. He could have played back in those days as well and hung with those guys. But
it's a different kind of, you know, LeBron James is a generational player. He could play in, you know, today. He could have played back then. He could play anytime. He's just, yep, you know, he's a Magic Johnson 2.0 for me. He's just the newer version of what Magic was. But for back then, when the game was different and Magic, you know, and Larry and Michael did what they did, you know, they carried those teams. You can be pretty sure that they're going to be in the finals every single year. And, you know, and these guys did like each other. And they were like, you know, they were bitter enemies. And where today's game is, these guys are buddies going against each other in the finals. And that's the only difference.
Yeah, I know you can definitely see that. Well, one of the things you did really successfully, I think, is you were always looking at this as, you know, blessed to be in the league, but at the same time, you want to develop yourself outside of the game because there's, you know, life after football, so to speak, in your case, life after basketball. And one of the things that I saw last night on this, again, this 360 video that was presented was your love of real estate and developing. And you, I mean, I was blown away at some of these different properties. It looked like, you know, some of these properties down on Miami Vice, the old show, right on the water, these beautiful homes, great structures, amazing architecture. And it just seems like you've got a real talent for continuing to do that. I don't know if you're still doing that today, but the properties that I saw that they showed on that piece were really amazing.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the thing is that I've always had an architectural mind and a very artistic mind. So for me, you know, music and design and stuff like that, it was just always something that, you know, that it was always innate. I always had it in me. This was something that I always went to, even during my NBA career. This is, I would always like, you know, I would have a subscription to all these beautiful homes in the world. And I would always take pictures of beautiful things that I would see in certain homes that I would visit. Because when you're in the NBA, you get access to amazing homes. And I would always look around and you know, just remember certain things that impressed me and stuff like that. And I just kept putting it in my database. And then while I was playing in the NBA, I decided to build my first house. So I designed and built the first house probably within my second year or third year in the league. And I figured I'll live in this house and see if I can sell it. And if I can sell it, I'm going to start doing this over and over. And that's how the whole story started. You know, I would just build a house. People would come in and they would love it. And I would just sell it. The first house I built, Shaquille O'Neal ended up buying it. And that's how the story, you know, went on. So it started like as something that I was doing half fun, half for the money. Now it's turned into I'm doing this as a business because I build houses that people, it's not complicated. It's just, it's got a great flow in it. I take advantage of the spaces and stuff like that. So it's something that, every year, every couple of years, I build a couple of homes. And before, when I was, you know, a bachelor, I would just sell the house that I'm living in. But now that I'm married and that I've been married and the kids, so I've had to keep the house that I live in and start building other houses and selling those.
Well, I was going to say that the only kink in the wheel that you were telling me is that the houses that I saw on this feature on you were just stunning. And so it's great that you're selling these and there's a market for it, but they're so amazing that I wouldn't want to move.
Well, that's why I'm not moving from this one anymore.
Well, good, 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 good. So your other interest, and this is really interesting, is you are a super accomplished, and correct me, I'm probably going to say this wrong, but a music DJ. And you specialize in house music. And I am not, I don't listen to that genre, but as I was going through listening to some of these tunes and I saw you on these clubs all over the world, it was just electric in terms of, packed, they're not arenas, but packed dance halls and everybody in there with all the energy and all the lights going and you're up there on the DJ thing with your headphones on and you're spinning these songs that you've created. I mean, it was really impressive.
Yeah, it's, I started making music. I started creating and making music about 11, 12 years ago. I really got addicted to the music making process. And so I got, I just really wanted to create music and put it out there. I didn't want to DJ. I didn't want to be in the front. I was doing this as a passion, as something that I loved doing. I never intended it for it to become public and for me to play in these clubs and venues and stuff like that around the world. But again, I was, one person convinced me to play in public once. And that was in Miami for the music conference about 8 years ago or 9 years ago. And I just did it for fun as an experiment. And it just kind of blew up from there. And it's just been going on since.
One of the places that I saw you in a venue that looked, this would have been really cool, I think, is going back to your roots, right? I think I saw you where you're in some venue, some club in Beirut, and you've got all this stuff going on. Everybody's going berserk, house lights up and down. Your music is blaring. It seemed like just like, wow, what amazing energy is being pumped into that club. What was that like?
You know, how can I explain this? You know, a lot of people want to know the difference between that and playing in a sport. Mm-hmm. It's two different things. Playing a sport, you've got a whole city that's riding on your back. You've got, it's a whole different thing. When you're playing music, you're basically in control of everybody's mood. So you can make these people either happy or unhappy. You know, it's just gonna, and most of the time, you can't make everybody happy, but if you can capture the crowd and have most of them to be on your vibe, then you've done your job for the night. So the hardest thing for me is just to kind of get everybody on the same vibe. And once you catch that, that's you're in charge of people's happiness. And that's basically what it is.
How do you make music? And because I don't, and I'm asking a really stupid question. And I honestly don't know the answer, you know, because you're not taking, it's this electro house music. So you're not taking like violins and drums and guitars and putting those together, right? Like you're playing those. How does that creative process come together?
It's exactly like an artist with a blank canvas. You can start with a violin. You can start with the drums. You can start with a vocal. You can start with anything that inspires you to start painting that canvas. I mean, you can start with different colors. You can start with whatever. And then, but you know, once you get going, you know where you're going to end up. But you just need that motivation. So sometimes it's guitars, sometimes it's violins, all computerized. So I don't have to have the physical guitar. I don't have to have the physical violin. I could probably have any instrument in this world available to me on the computer to play versus having the actual hardware for it or physical equipment.
What is the, you know, like back in the day, I don't know if this is still the case, like when you start talking about pop, you know, top tunes, pop or country, typically songs are 3 to 3.5 minutes, I think. What is the typical duration of a house music song that you're going to create?
Just, you know, it's always the difference between house music and basically commercial music is, you know, you've got a minute in the beginning and a minute at the end that you have an intro and outro for DJs to come into your song. So basically that first minute is kind of the intro and the last minute is the outro. But the meat and potatoes is still about 4 minutes.
Yep.
So you've got 4 minutes of your song, and then you've got the intro and outro, which turn it into a 6 minute track. So it's anywhere between, if you can keep the song interesting, it can go anywhere from, you know, 6 minutes to 12 minutes to 14 minutes, as long as you can keep it interesting.
Yeah, that's really cool. So do you continue to, I would imagine you do, full time, developing real estate and this other passion of yours, creating music. Is that what you do full time now?
That is exactly what I do.
Well, you're living the good life down in Miami. I saw you out there cruising around on your boats, you know, outside of your house. And it looks like life has treated you very well. Now, how often do you get back to Greece? Is that where your parents are?
Well, my parents are in Lebanon. And I get to Lebanon probably twice a year, three times a year. Yeah. And then to Greece, I go every summer. We spend a little bit of time there. I go visit my sister, who has a summer house in Greece. You know, this is, it's really been, I've been honestly like, I, you know, I'm not going to take credit for anything, but just, you know, I've been blessed and I've been able to kind of pursue the passions in my life where I felt like I've never worked a day in my life, but I work just as hard as everybody else. But it just doesn't feel like work because I'm just so passionate about everything I do. So I'm happy that, you know, my career didn't die when I stopped playing basketball, but gave me another 35, 40 years of something else to focus on and be inspired by.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, look, we all are given certain kind of gifts, and it's what you do with them is the difference maker. Whether you're in real estate, you're an athlete, you're a banker, it doesn't really matter. It always gets down to the person who gets after it the hardest. And usually those are the people that get rewarded. So good for you. Listen, love what you're doing. Totally appreciate you coming on the podcast. And good luck to you in the future with all your different endeavors. And been an inspiration to a lot of people. So thank you for that.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you. I really appreciate that. Good luck in your climbing.
Thank you, buddy. Thank you. Really appreciate it. Okay, there he is, Ronnie Cicely. Thank you.
Hey, and thank you so much for listening to the Find Your Summit podcast. We are so glad to have you along for this journey. And if you enjoy the show, please tell a friend, share it on iTunes, spread it to the planet. We're looking to broadcast this to every person that is out there because, as you know, everybody has their own summit that they're going after. Okay, if you're looking to follow my journey, you can find that through my social links on markpattisonnfl.com. That's Mark, M-A-R-K, Pattison, P-A-T-T-I-S-O-N, nfl.com. So, until the next podcast, just remember, clear eyes, full hearts, and remember, it takes a little more to make a champion, so make it happen. Thank you. Bye.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.